Well, I'm supposed to help set the stage for a kind of a panel discussion on demand development or market development in the Asia area. So I'll do that, but I'll do it very quickly. And I'll be providing not necessarily a 30,000-foot view, but maybe a suborbital view. But then I'll let Adele and Carrie get into the specifics. This is, let me get here to, this is where we're located in terms of office staff and country representatives. You can see, there is a pointer here somewhere, and I don't know how to use this high technology stuff either. You can see Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. These are permanent offices of the council. And then we have country representatives in Philippines and Vietnam, and also down here in Indonesia. These fellows, at least in the Philippines and Indonesia, their focus is primarily on DDG promotion. So that's that's where we're located. We've had a long presence in the Asia for the past 45 to 50 years, starting out initially in Japan, long before I came around, and we continue to remain very excited about the large and stable markets which Japan, Korea, and Taiwan represent, but also we're also very enthusiastic and look very positively toward the new developing opportunities, in particularly in China and in Southeast Asia. This is just a quick recap of the feed grain supply and demand situation in that part of the world. Again, very high overview. Total consumption of grain, of feed grain, throughout that area, about 9 billion bushel. Total production within the Asia area, there's around 8 billion bushel of feed grain being produced. So, in a manner of speaking, that's the first line of competition that we're facing in the Asia arena, is simply the domestic corn that is or grain that's being produced in the region itself. Total import trade, there's about 1.5 billion bushel of feed grain that's moving into the Asia area, of which we're currently getting about 1 billion bushel of that trade, or roughly 71% market share. What's it worth? Probably conservatively about $4.5 billion of revenue to U.S. agriculture generated from those sales. Population-wise, very big. As you can see here, about 2 billion people right now in the area, and expected to grow over the next 10 years to expand another 300 million mouths to feed, basically equivalent to the size of the U.S. So, large and impressive consumer base that does and will have the economic power to buy what they need, as reflected in this next graph. This simply illustrates the rapid rebound in economic growth from the downturn in 08, with long-term and relatively high levels of economic performance expected over the next 8 to 10 years, especially in places like China and in some of the developing markets like Vietnam, Indonesia, down in Southeast Asia. So a lot of people, but also they have the wherewithal to to buy what they need. Uh, what do we do? Basically, just very simply, we say we build the engines which drive we drive demand. In collaboration with our local partners, the council's footprint in Asia is very large, and our impact is felt in establishing and expanding the demand drivers in the feed, livestock, industrial processing industries throughout the region. Through a wide range of technical assistance and trade servicing programs, we've been helping our partners to find solutions to production problems and issues which affect their ability to purchase, process, utilize U.S. feed grains and our co-products. I think, in short, what we do, we accelerate. We're not the end-all, I guess, or be-all. I mean, things would still probably go on if we weren't there, but I think that we bring a lot to the table in terms of accelerating, speeding up that demand coming on stream. We also don't sell, but what we do is to create the environment and the opportunity in which those sales can take place. The issues and constraints, you could probably look worldwide at any market and find most of these, and these are certainly alive and well in the Asia arena. Right now, I guess, probably competition. Again, you heard me talk about that big slug of domestic grain that's being produced in places like China. So there's plenty of competition from there, coming also from South America. Some coming out of India. This year, and to a certain extent last year, grain quality was a major issue for us, and it continues to be something that we have to wrestle with. And then in some of the countries, some of the lesser developed countries like Indonesia, there's still a fairly low level of per capita consumption when you compare what their neighbors are doing in places like Malaysia. Malaysia has, I think, roughly 60 pounds per person consumption of poultry, and basically the Malaysians and the Indonesians have the same cultural and dietary habits. But when you look at Indonesia, that consumption is probably not much more than 7 or 8 pounds per capita, and so a lot of scope to increase consumption and of course feed grain utilization. Again, the issues just continue on. A lot of what we do is to provide technical and managerial assistance. Those seem to be the predominant barriers as we look at working in the feed and livestock industries. Some tariff barriers, not as serious there as what we see in other markets around the world. So that's not, it doesn't necessarily consume a lot of our time in that area. Biotechnology has been another issue for us to wrestle with, particularly in countries like Japan and Korea. Be that as it may, biotechnology does not prevent trade. I mean, still the lion's share of feed grain purchases going into Japan or going into Korea are not really impacted by the biotechnology issues or concerns of consumers. Key strategies, again, these are just the kind of the mix, and I won't go down the list, but these are the kind of initiatives and strategies that we put in place to respond directly to the issues and constraints that were in the previous slide. Our target audience, whether they're feed mill ingredient purchasing managers or swine, dairy, poultry operators, or technicians, managers, folks that have the responsibility for the day-to-day production and management of these farms, and a lot of these farms are rapidly commercializing. They're going to a lot larger scale, so they require a level of of technology and managerial expertise that that we're helping to provide. So again, feed millers, they're part of our target audience, industrial processors. We don't see a large industrial processing industry other than in Japan and Korea. And of course, consumers, they'll also require some attention, particularly as we look at promoting new products into the market, like barley food applications or sorghum applications into the food industry. Many years ago, when we first started working in the Asia area, consumer education and promotion was, in fact, a very large amount of the activity and the work that we were carrying on, just introducing people to the improved poultry and pork and dairy and beef products. So that's all good. That's general background information. You might say, well, what have you done for us lately? So here's just a few examples. And Adele will probably get into a little bit more specifics, but here a few months ago, he conducted a Southeast Asia Buyers Conference where there was about 1.4 million tons of U.S. ag products that got sold. This conference is designed and targeted at a very elite group of buyers and customers in the Southeast Asia area. These programs have been going on now for about 6 years, and they all of them proved to be very, very beneficial. It's not just a matter of coming together, having a conference, and everybody say, well, we had a good time and go home. They actually make deals. There's opportunities at these conferences for buyers and sellers to get together and to actually negotiate trades. The last one was held in the Philippines back in September, and U.S. corn and distillers grains were marketed during that time, I think around 263,000 ton and valued at somewhere around $34 million. Taiwan would be another example of something that has been recently accomplished back in September. The Taiwanese came to town and re-upped or signed another letter of intent to purchase around 10 million tons of U.S. feed grain, as well as the DDG. These goodwill missions don't just happen. The council office in Taiwan takes a high degree of leadership in making sure that these groups get pulled together and do come to town. These are the Taiwanese government officials from the Bureau of Foreign Trade, as well as the Agricultural Ministry. But it takes a lot of coordination. It takes a lot of their own PR work to keep these folks interested enough to come and to re-up these purchasing agreements every couple of years. U.S. export credit guarantees have been really helpful in a country like Korea. Not quite sure where that whole GSM 102 program stands for 2010, but certainly last year that program was very instrumental in helping us to hang on to a significant amount of U.S. share in the Korean market. At the end of March, the GSM 102 guarantee for Korea was increased another $300 million, for a total of about $900 million, which was almost double from the previous year. This line of credit is used primarily by the Korean feed industry. I think they used about nearly 500 million of the total allocation to import a little over 2 million tons of corn and about 90,000 tons of soybean meal and another 50-some thousand tons of distiller dried grain. Very valuable program. Again, Korea is a very price-sensitive, price-conscious market. It's always a task. It's always a big job to try to keep them buying U.S., and the GSM 102 program has been very instrumental in doing that. Again, not sure where the program is headed 2010, but you have a voice in those political arenas, I think that any time that you can offer support for that 102 facility, I think it's would be very beneficial to do so. Just quickly, China, we finally have started to see a little bit of payoff after many years of market development work, technology transfer, buyer education, you name it, and but over the last year, we've seen a dramatic increase in sales of DDG to that country. I think last year we only had about 8,000 tons that went into China, and now you pick a number, but it's probably close to 500,000 tons of DDG that are now going in there. And I think that a lot of the credit can go directly to the council for, you know, getting in there and over the last 4 years to introduce that product, to demonstrate its use, and to work with buyers on how to procure it, putting buyers and sellers together. Again, we're glad to see something finally pay off. In terms of the answer to the question that came up earlier, when's China going to import some corn? There was a question earlier this morning that was asked to our speaker, what's going to happen to the dollar? Well, she didn't have the answer to that, and I don't have the answer to when China's going to import corn. According to the smart people, USDA analysts and others, they have a chart which shows Chinese exports, how they've continued to trend down and to where now they're below the line and where China turns actually into a net importer. And they show that happening in 2011, 2012. I don't know whether I'd be willing to sign make any major commitment to that. Todd Meyer, who used to be our director in China, he would often say he's become bearish on being bullish. So I guess we've all kind of become kind of conservative and reluctant to get too far out ahead in our projections. Do we believe it? Do we think it's going to happen long term? Absolutely. Don't think they have the land base. Yes, they can apply biotechnology. They can utilize improved agronomic techniques, other technologies, and they will expand yield. They will expand production. But I don't think that any of us believe that they'll be able to keep pace with the growing demand in animal agriculture and the food needs of their people. We don't think that they will be able to meet all of their needs. Again, those USDA projections show China importing, I think, 2 million ton by around 2012, 2013. Hope it happens. In the meantime, we'll take as much of the DDG business as we can get. All right. We're always looking for new frontiers, new things to do, innovative ideas. And we've been able to find those, of course, with the DDG, but also in recent years we did a lot of work with the polylactic acid, the PLA products in Taiwan and also Japan. And then also some novel and innovative work in developing specific food applications for U.S. sorghum and barley, and that work continues to move ahead in places like Taiwan and Japan. Here's DDG again, and you'll see that kind of the theme of DDG runs through just about everything that we have good to say about our markets in that part of the world. But we simply can't contain our excitement and enthusiasm for the manner in which, by and large, all of the markets in Asia have embraced that product. I wouldn't want to characterize our DDG efforts as being like shooting fish in a barrel, but this has been a very easy product, if you will, compared to other things that we've tried to do in the past. DDG has been really an easy product to promote and to gain consumer interest and confidence in. Results have been great in just four short years. They've come fast and certainly beyond our wildest imagination. The markets in Asia and in Canada now are well, 2 million, right up there at 2 million ton, particularly in Asia, and then if you add Canada in on top of that, probably another 800,000 tons. So good things going. We think they'll continue, and we should be able to. You've seen this chart earlier. Eric had it up there, but of this 10 million growth, or 5 million growth above where we are now, over the next 5 years or so, hopefully we'll be exporting 10 million ton. I think easily we'll see half of that amount be going into the Asia arena. With that, I better sit down and turn things over to Carrie and to Adele, and they'll kind of finish out and complete the story and the picture on demand development in the Asia area. Thank you.